seated. Thank you very much. Today we have first argument in this case number 56640. Our Lenders LLC versus Branch Banking et al. And let's go ahead, Mr. Merrill. We'll start with you. And my understanding is you've worked out a time arrangement with each other on rebuttal arguments because we have a cross appeal in the case as well.
We have, Your Honor, yes.
Okay.
Good morning, Your Honors. Thank you very much. May it please the Court, David Merrill on behalf of the appellant and cross respondent, R&S St. Louis Lenders LLC. This morning my argument will focus on the BB&T appeal, as I believe that's probably more, you can tell by the briefing, the more critical issue that is at stake here. BB&T's appeal arises from a trial on the merits in which the district court considered whether BB&T could upset the recorded order of two deeds in trust. However, ultimately the case is about BB&T's failure to prove its case. And failure to prove that it had any interest in the note and deed of trust.
Can I ask a couple questions? Because this case kind of baffled me trying to chart it out here and what happened. So there was no subordination agreement ever signed at the time that this subsequent loan came on.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. No subordination agreement. And there was not even a request for a subordination agreement.
Okay.
There was a request for a reconveyance, but that occurred a year later, even though St. Louis Lenders' note and deed of trust wasn't paid off. Now, BB&T will argue that this case is about standing or it's a real party and interest issue, and they do that because they want this court to do a de novo review. However, this case is not about a lack of standing. It's not about a real party and interest, and the court must apply the substantial evidence standard. The district court, BB&T failed to prove its case. The district court did not determine that BB&T lacked standing. The district court did not determine that BB&T was not the real party and interest. The district court determined, based upon the evidence that it had before it, that it couldn't determine whether BB&T was assigned the note and the deed of trust from the FDIC. Now, this is no different than in a contract case, a breach of contract case. If I have a contract, a written contract, and I'm a party to that contract, but at trial or on summary judgment, I don't introduce any evidence that this contract even exists, I would lose my case. I'd fail to prove my case. That's not a lack of standing of a breach of contract. It's a failure to prove your case issue. And that's essentially what happened here and what the district court did. Now, BB&T's failure of proof in this case is remarkable because of the opportunities that the district court gave it to try and submit its proof. 2 months before trial, the district court noted what issues were going to be tried on the merits, and one of those issues concerned the nature of the alleged assignment. What did BB&T get from the FDIC, if anything? Nevertheless, BB&T did not introduce the purchase and assumption agreement as a pretrial exhibit and didn't identify any witnesses who were going to testify about that. On the very first day of trial, keep in mind this trial started in January 8th of 2010. On that very first day, there was an objection, there was argument and discussion about what BB&T had and what they did have or didn't have, if anything. And the court said, and I quote, and this is volume 6 of the appendix, 1165 to 66, district court said, I have to make a determination as to whether there's an assignment that exists, if it's a successor in interest that exists, or it's some other nature of an acquisition. So the first day of trial, the court says, I have to make this determination. Despite this clear statement, BB&T still put on no evidence of the purchase and assumption agreement or any testimony as to what the nature of the alleged acquisition was. And what's remarkable is here is, even though the trial only lasted...
I understand that the purchase and assumption agreement was never produced in discovery, and that was reason the judge didn't allow it to trial.
No, not exactly. The purchase assumption agreement was not produced in discovery, but everybody knew about it, and so even though they didn't introduce it in the case in chief, the district judge did allow that to come into evidence after the close of the case in chief. There was a subsequent assignment that was done in October of 2009 that they hadn't produced in discovery, and the district judge precluded them from introducing that into evidence. And keep in mind here that even again, this was in New Year's, where the first day of trial is, and the judge says, this is an issue I have to decide. The trial isn't finished until April, even though it goes 7-8 days. BB&T had three and a half months to marshal its evidence and put on its evidence that it, in fact, received an assignment of the note and deed of trust from the FDIC, and it failed to do so. Again, and to Your Honor's question, the district court did allow the purchase and assumption agreement to come in, but the district court, after looking at the purchase and assumption agreement, said it's internally inconsistent. There were schedules that were supposed to be attached that weren't attached. It was incomplete, and under Section 3.5 and 3.6, there were exceptions that applied that the district court said, these exceptions could apply. I can't tell whether this did, in fact, assign you the note and the deed of trust. In fact, the district court said, and I quote, it prevents the court, these internally inconsistent in the purchase agreement, it prevents the court from making a finding that an assignment has occurred of the loan that is at issue. That was the decision of the district court. So the district court said, BB&T, do you have any other evidence? BB&T left. They came back the next day and they said, here we go. We have a 2009 assignment. It was done in October of 2009. That they had failed to disclose. And the district court said, you didn't disclose under 16.1. I'm going to preclude you from introducing that evidence into that exhibit into evidence. BB&T then asked the district court to reopen its case in chief. The district court said, yeah, I'll allow you to reopen your case in chief. BB&T then pulls out another document that it created that day or the day before and said, here's our assignment. This cures everything. We want to go ahead and now introduce this second assignment, which is done in 2010. And again, the district court said, you can't create a document in the middle of trial to try and get around your disclosure obligations. I'm not going to allow you to introduce that in. The district court then said, do you have any other evidence? And BB&T said, no. They didn't put on any testimony, any witnesses, nothing. They could have called somebody in. They could have used a deposition transcript of somebody saying, this is what the PAA means. This is what it did. We're the holder of the note. They put on no evidence whatsoever. They rested their case, and the district court said, I have to grant St. Rose Lenders Rule 52 motion because you didn't prove your case. Now, the purchase and assumption agreement is crystal clear by itself, without any testimony, is not sufficient under this court's opinion in Leyva to transfer the note and deed of trust.
Let's ask that. Are the cases in jurisprudence that come out of foreclosure mediation applicable, or should we be looking at our constituted law under UCC that pertains to general commercial type lending transactions?
Well, I think Leyva did exactly that. In the opinion in Leyva, the court says this is coming out of the foreclosure mediation program, but we're taking this opportunity to clarify what the UCC is.
Very, very specific as to the problems or problematic nature of home ownership, not commercial transactions.
Correct, but the UCC still applies, and Leyva goes through the analysis of the UCC of how you transfer a note and deed of trust under the terms of the UCC, and that wouldn't matter whether it was a note that was done in a residential context or whether it was done in a commercial context. The UCC applies regardless of what context that's done, and in Leyva, the court said, if you want to transfer the note, you have to endorse it. It has to be endorsed, or the original has to be given possession over, and there has to be some evidence or testimony about it was given over and transferred for the purpose of enforcement. Again, there was no evidence that the BB&T had the original note. There was no testimony on that. There was no testimony that was given to them for the purpose of enforcement. There was no nothing in this case.
What about Edelstein, subsequent to Leyva? Is that applicable for the same reasons Justice Douglas mentioned?
I think Edelstein, in the situation there, again, I don't think it changes the issue. Edelstein was whether, if the note is split, the deed of trust, it comes back and reverses. This is not a merge situation. There was the note and deed of trust were in the same person. So I think Edelstein actually supports us. It still stands for the proposition that if you want to transfer, if you want to sign the note and the deed of trust, you have to do it in accordance with the UCC. They didn't do that here, and they didn't try and submit any testimony saying we have the original note and it was given to us for purposes of enforcement. And that goes to the next issue of BB&T's argument. They cite this Navari case, Navari 33 out of the Northern District of Florida, and they say, Navari said the purchase and assumption agreement alone was sufficient. Well, that's not exactly the case. In Navari 33, first of all, it was a breach of a promissory note case. Here we had a priority dispute case. because it was a breach of a promissory note case, it wouldn't fall under 3.5B, the exception of the purchase and assumption agreement, whereas this is a priority dispute, so it could fall under 3.5B.
What relief are you seeking from this court for your client?
With respect to our appeal against Commonwealth, the relief that we're seeking here is the note that the court entered judgment on was crystal clear that it had a 5% late payment, late fee for any delinquent payments. And our position was, at the time of maturity of the note, there can be no further delinquent payments.
But we went through the stipulation of a senator in open court and went through that language, and it seemed like, although maybe you have a good argument, but it seems like the stipulation may have resolved that issue.
I don't think it resolved that issue for a couple things. One, if the note is unambiguous, which we believe it is, it's a pure question of law, and you can't stipulate to what the law is. You could stipulate to what the facts are or how the facts are applied. I believe
you just stipulate the interest calculations and all in open court.
What did you stipulate? What was stipulated then?
The stipulation in open court was we believed, looking at the spreadsheet, that the spreadsheet was accurate. However, the stipulation also included a provision that the order that was to be prepared by Mr. Keach was supposed to be signed off by both of us, and that is in the transcript. And when we looked at the order and what they were actually doing it, the spreadsheet was misleading. It looked like a total balance, a running balance, as opposed to an actual monthly balance. And so because of that, when we got the order, we objected to the order. We said, no, this is not proper. We didn't stipulate to this. And in none of the orders that the district court had entered did they say, yeah, you in fact stipulated this, so that's why I'm doing it. It's purely a question of law. There can be no late payments after maturity, and because of that, we don't believe the stipulation would apply.
Okay. What about the court not allowing the FDIC to be brought into the case?
We believe that's a red herring, Your Honor, because, again, the court did not make a determination that BB&T was not the real party in interest, and the FDIC was, in fact, the real party in interest. The court's determination was, I can't tell, based upon the evidence you presented, whether or not you have any rights to enforce this. And so there wasn't a determination that BB&T, you're not the real party in interest, and therefore FDIC, you are, and we should bring you in. So that's the issue here as to why this is not a standing real party in interest issue. It's a failure of proof issue. And so we don't believe that the FDIC should have been brought in because the court couldn't make that determination. And BB&T tries to blame the court for that, saying, well, gee, if it was ambiguous, you should have made that determination. And the district court is saying, how can I make that determination? There's no evidence. You haven't presented the evidence by which I can make that determination. So it's a pure failure of proof issue. And so we believe that that is a red herring. With the respect to the exclusion of the 2009 assignment and the 2010 assignment, we think it's pretty clear that the policy under 16.1 is full disclosure. You have to supplement under 26E1, and under 16.1A3, you have to disclose documents which may be used at trial. They didn't do so, even though it was prepared 6-7 months before they tried to get it in. The 16.1E is crystal clear that the court shall impose sanctions in that situation, and the district court was particularly concerned in this situation because of prior orders ordering production of documents and prior orders over denying a protective order, allowing us to take depositions and go into these areas, and that's where the district court was concerned. And so I don't believe it was abuse of discretion for the district court to keep either of those assignments out. I see I'm in my rebuttal time, Your Honor. If you have anything else, I'll sit for now.
You have about 2 minutes and 25 seconds. You can reserve that.
Thank you.
Okay, let's see who's up next here.
Good morning. Please, the court, Scott Geiser on behalf of Respondent Commonwealth Land Title Insurance Company, which is the assignee of Robert Murdoch and Eckley Keach. I am just on the main appeal dealing with the interest calculation.
Mr. Geiser, can I ask you, because this thing really, again, I used to practice in this area, and this thing is unbelievable to me, trying to graph out what happened. But did Mr. Keach and Mr. Murdoch ever get an assignment of a partial beneficial interest in a deed of trust or not? Or did he say, I was confused from the record.
No, so what happened is Mr. Murdoch and Mr. Keach received promissory notes from what was saying
$500,000.
Correct. They never had an actual interest in the deed, the St. Rose lender's deed of trust. They only had.
They were unsecured.
They were unsecured, exactly. After the judgment in this case, pursuant to judgment, had to write a court, Commonwealth purchased the judgment that Murdoch and Keech had obtained and began enforcing those rights. Okay. Mr. Murdoch and Mr. Keech are no longer part of the case. They have their interests have been purchased and assigned to Commonwealth. So as far as the actual issues regarding BB&T and its rights, Commonwealth is, you know, fully supportive of the positions being taken by BB&T in this appeal. And if the court wants me to speak at all about the actual interest issues, I mean, really the position of Commonwealth is, as the court noted, there was a stipulation very clearly on the record that said when Mr. Keech made the representation, we spoke to Mr. Merrill, he's agreed to the calculations attached to our summary judgment motion as explained, and that ends the need for a prove-up hearing. Mr. Merrill then confirmed that, and that was the end of it. Under Bogus, we believe that's binding, and that pretty much ends the issue.
What about Mr. Merrill's argument? You can't have a, I think it's a, is it a late charge on a balloon payment?
That's his position, and our position is, we interpret it that you absolutely can, that that's what the note allowed, that lenders drafted the note. If there's an ambiguity, it gets construed against them. We never had the opportunity really to discuss the issue before the court because we had the stipulation and it wasn't necessary. But we believe that at best it's ambiguous, and in that case it gets construed against lenders.
Okay, so the Commonwealth, and I understand that, and again, maybe you're not that interested in some of these issues. I am, though.
But absolutely.
I'm Commonwealth. I assume you're in this. You bought out Keech and Murdoch. Probably, so it must be a title issue. The only reason you would have bought them out. How are you involved as far as the Jewish Retirement Insurance to BB&T?
Yes, Commonwealth is the insurer of the BB&T deed of trust.
What about the we had the first and the second, which apparently were not reconveyed when this new deed of trust was recorded? What happened there? It's something. I understand that. These are pretty big dollar amounts.
I understand that. My understanding of it, why I wasn't involved in the transaction, but reading the testimony, the position of BB&T and Commonwealth was always the understanding that the St. Rose lender's deed of trust would either be reconveyed or subordinated some sort of way. Mm-hmm. It's the reason why I think, any construction lender, BB&T or actually Colonial, put it right in their deed of trust. I think it was Section 5.03 that says, we subrogate in the position of any lien that we pay off, and there's absolutely no dispute here that the first $29 million of the BB or the Colonial Bank loan went to pay off the original Colonial Bank deed of trust. They then put right in their deed of trust that we would thereby subrogate into the position of that lien, and under Houston and the equitable subrogation doctrine, really, they should be subrogated into that position. That was, that is the position that Commonwealth would take now. But as far as in the actual transaction, it was the understanding that St. Rose deed of trust would be subordinated or removed in some way so that the Colonial deed of trust would be in the insured first position.
Okay. I just want to advise the parties. There's a case pending in the Nevada Supreme Court called Zhang versus Recon Trust or Trust Company, case number 58602. Against Zhang, Z-H-A-N-G, 58602, where that the issue is, does the court recognize equitable subrogation in this type of scenario? It was a payoff, somewhat similar to this, and the court has already heard an argument on that. It's under submission. The court hasn't decided that, but reading this, I knew it's going to have a big impact on this case, potentially, here, and I just wanted to call that to your attention, take a look at that.
Absolutely, and I'm very familiar with the issues of equitable subrogation and the Houston decision and the following decisions after that, as far as even the court's most recent decision in Fountain Blue that restricts it to basically this scenario, lender versus lender, mm-hmm. rather than involving a mechanics lien, but the restatement issues are very clear. St. Rose is only moving up in the priority chain because of the benefit of Colonial paying off its own deed of trust. This is really what equitable subrogation was designed to protect against. It is essentially a windfall to someone in lender's position.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. Your Honor, I'm Glenn Meyer. I'm pleased to be here today representing BB&T. Mm-hmm. Our position is that what happened at the trial court was that the trial court judge mistakenly shifted the burden of proof on the standing issue after BB&T had already come forward with prima facie evidence to demonstrate that it had been assigned the note and attempted to make BB&T disprove an exclusion, when in reality that it should have been RNS and the RNS parties.
Well, how did you prove your ownership of the note due to trust?
Very simply, in exactly the same way that BB&T did in the Florida court in the Navari case. By putting forward the purchase and assumption agreement, which starts with the idea that everything that was an asset of Colonial is passing through the FDIC and on to BB&T. So you start from that position, that has to be the default. Once the PAA is introduced, there is evidence that all assets of Colonial Bank, except those that are expressly excluded, and that's important, expressly excluded, now belong to BB&T. So that's why I say at that point, BB&T had met its burden of production of a prima facie case showing that it had standing, and this was a standing issue, and I'm more than happy to talk about that some if that's something that's seriously in question by the court.
Was what was presented sufficient? Because it was asserted that what was provided at some point was missing various schedules.
Your Honor, what happens, and this was discussed at trial, is this procedure of an FDIC takeover and transfer of assets to an assuming bank happens very quickly. And it's not unusual for this larger agreement not to appear to be complete.
That type of situation, but the question is, within the transfer, the real question that this jurisdiction has been faced with is, were there deficiencies in what in fact got transferred?
And I don't believe there were, Your Honor, because, again, there was no evidence of any express exclusion. All of the provisions of the purchase and assumption agreement that RNS points to as being possible ways that this may have been excluded, all of those require some affirmative determination by the FDIC that there is an exclusion. So if there was an exclusion, well, where is the evidence of it? RNS talked a lot about what BB&T didn't produce. Our position is, if there was evidence of an exclusion, and they wanted to argue that this asset was excluded, but that was their burden to do.
Okay, so Mr. Meyer, if I can sum it up, if I understand your position, is that I don't think we have a case here on an FDIC takeover, that we've looked at, but we know this happened, Washington Mutual case, people like that, and also those big banks have done this, but the question is, how do we get the proper paperwork here for on these loans and all to show through the borrowers, who the heck owns their due to trust now? We have this bulk purchase, but apparently there's no recorded assignments, no the beneficial interest of the deeds of trust. There's this big gaping hole here, and we've addressed that, as Justice Douglas brought out in the single-family residential context about, the securitized loans and nobody knows who owns them. So we, I think, establishing jurisprudence in that area. What do we need to do here to fill in this black hole here on the ownership issue?
Well, again, I don't know that there's anything you need to do to fill it in, because you can just go back to the contract documents. And the contract documents start again with this broad transfer and say, look for a carve-out. So I think the standard you should be setting is, if a borrower on a loan seriously wants to contest that it's not transferred, then it's up to them to come forward once there's been a prima facie evidence of a general transfer. It's up to the borrower to come up with evidence of a specific exclusion. They can certainly request that type of information in discovery. They can obtain it. If there had been anything like that here, I'm sure they would have worked.
Well, let me ask you this. Let's say you were going to start foreclosure on this. You're now BB&T, acquired for Colonial. No assignment of beneficial interest in deed of trust has been recorded. What do you do in this state that we have private foreclosures and all? How do you institute that foreclosure under Nevada law to proceed? What do you need to do that?
Well, and I do have to correct one point about the record, which is that there was an assignment. The October 2009 assignment that the district court did not admit into evidence was a recorded assignment and was a record. So
this is the one that wasn't produced and discovered.
That's correct. And that's the only ground on which
isn't that part of the chain, you need to put together.
It is, Your Honor. Now, I believe also that the state of the record is that document didn't exist until after the close of discovery. So that's another point, because you have to look at when you talk about these transfers, and you do want these interests to be freely transferable because it promotes commercial interests, are you going to create a situation where once you hit a discovery cutoff and a piece of litigation, that those interests can no longer be transferred, that they have to be held by whoever has them?
Let me ask you this, because then that's a difference. That's abuse of discretion that we have to review for what the district court did in not admitting that into evidence. What about the time gap between the time this document existed and was recorded until it was offered for production, you know, like that seems to be a problem that the judge had, or am I mistaken?
No, I don't think you are mistaken. I think that was a problem that the judge had, and I think that the only thing that the record reveals to me is that BB&T believed what it believes today, that the purchase and assumption agreement demonstrated that it had been assigned the interest. Okay. And that once it had enough, the question that you have to answer is not whether there's more that BB&T could have done, but did BB&T do enough? And I think the state of the record shows that BB&T felt that the purchase and assumption agreement adequately demonstrated that. The judge obviously disagreed. We think that that her interpretation of the purchase and assumption agreement was incorrect. We think you should follow on with what the court did in Navarre and find that that was an appropriate way to prove that that interest had been transferred.
So Justice Douglas's previous question about the missing schedules and all like that, you don't think that matters then?
I don't think that matters because I think you're going to find that in situations like this, there is always the potential for a general document to refer to schedules that in then that particular case either don't get created because there are no assets to exclude or are not created until much later on. Again, these things, and you pointed out, Your Honor, that you know this is a situation we're unfortunately a little too familiar with here in Nevada, but this is stuff that happens very quickly and then sort of gets taken care of after the fact.
But isn't that the very reason that since we're sitting in this place where we're going to make rules, if you will, with respect to transfer of properties, isn't that why we need to be so very careful about being sure that there is a proper, adequate paper trail? I'm completely with you on your, you know, once there's this contract that says, unless there's a specific exclusion, you get it all. Pretty clear. Okay. But I guess maybe we're looking at a bigger picture. And that is that we're concerned, you yourself said these transactions take place like that. Maybe we aren't as concerned in the commercial arena as we have been in the single-family property ownership, but I think that perhaps we should be.
Well, I would just say to this, Your Honor, and I see that I'm also in my rebuttal time, so let me answer your question and then reserve it.
We have extra time.
But let me just say in response to that at least on the record in this case, there's no evidence that there was any type of duplicity on the part of the FDIC, that this was some effort to hide evidence, that the borrower is confused about who owned its note. There's no evidence of that, and I think the reason why there's no evidence of that is because in these types of transactions where you have sophisticated commercial parties, they're able to figure that stuff out on their own. And so I think your rules that you develop in that arena can certainly be a little broader than they are in the residential arena. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I will give you an additional minute in time, and Mr. Merrill, I'll give you an additional minute as well for your rebuttal. Let's see, I forget the order.
I forgot my order too. Your Honor, real briefly, BB&T essentially is arguing that the burden of proof is shifted to us. It's their burden of proof to prove that they received an assignment of the note in the deed of trust, and the purchase and assumption agreement simply did not do that. And if you look at it specifically, section 3.5 of the purchase and assumption agreement says, the assuming bank, which would be BB&T, does not purchase, acquire, or assume, or, except as otherwise expressly provided in this agreement, obtain an option to purchase, acquire, or assume under this agreement, section 3.5b, any interest, right, action, claim, or judgment against, Roman numeral 4, any other person whose action or inaction may be related to any loss, exclusive of any loss resulting from such person's failure to pay on a loan made by the failed bank, incurred by the failed bank, provided that, for the purposes hereof, the acts, omissions, or other events giving rise to any such claim shall have occurred on or before bank closing. Okay? That's the issue that the district court had. One of the issues that the district court had. It wasn't a situation where the receiver has to come in and say, we're not going to give you this document. This says they don't get it.
Let me ask you this. Did the judge abuse her discretion in not admitting that a subsequent assignment was offered by counsel?
She did not abuse her discretion because 16.1 is crystal clear that there has to be disclosure. They had an opportunity to disclose it in their pretrial disclosures. It was created before their pretrial disclosures were due. They didn't disclose it. The judge told them on the first day, this is an issue. They didn't disclose it. 3-4 months go by. They don't disclose anything. And then after they rest their case in chief, they come back and they say, here we go, judge. Here's our assignment. It is absolutely not abuse of discretion. The court gave them opportunity after opportunity after opportunity to fix their problem, and they didn't do it. The UCC under LEDA is very clear what they needed to do. They didn't do it. They didn't introduce this document into evidence. 16.1 is crystal clear that there must be a sanction here, and the sanction was excluding the document.
So you're asking us to affirm as to you, the judge's ruling as to BB&T and reverse as to Commonwealth?
Yeah. Reverse not as to liability, but reverse as to the calculation and remand for a proper calculation of damages.
Okay.
That's correct, but affirm everything else. That's,
okay,
that's right,
it.
Your Honor. And again, I think BB&T and with the Section 3.5 that I read, that I provided to the court, that wasn't the issue in Navarre. Navarre dealt with a breach of contract, dealt with a breach of the note. The damage, the loss, was the failure to pay in Navarre. Navarre didn't have fraud allegations.
Well, let me ask you this, Mayor. Assuming we don't look at Navarre, obviously we look at all cases. But let's say we don't agree with Navarre, and we haven't even discussed that, but let me just say hypothetically we don't agree with it. If you have a bulk acquisition like you do when J.P. Morgan bought Washington Mutual, and you probably have millions of mortgages or deeds of trust and all like that, why shouldn't the bulk assignment through the FDIC control?
Mm-hmm. Well, because, again, the UCC provides that it doesn't. The UCC provides that it requires, and this court's opinion in labor requires, a specific negotiation of the note that simply wasn't done here. There was no evidence of that. And I actually am very familiar with those kind of bulk purchases, and a lot of times they're mergers where the document stays with everyone. This was not a merger.
Right.
This was a sale, and it wasn't a sale.
Well, I did think about that because I think when Bank of America acquired Security Pacific or some of those.
Wells Fargo Wachovia is the.
Right. You just say they were successor and interest through the merger.
Correct.
So my thought in preparing for this case was, can BB&T use that type of analogy like the Wells Fargo Wachovia?
I don't believe so, because they have said in their brief that it didn't purchase all of the assets. I see my time is up.
Also, before you sit down, I'd like to go back to the purported stipulation.
That's right.
Because that was, in fact, the parties brought that back to the court after there was a disagreement as to whether the stipulation was to be binding. And the position of the parties was argued to the court. What's your position as to the argument that was made to the court and the ruling by the court?
Well, I don't know that the court ever made a determination in any of the orders that we were bound by the stipulation. I think the court made a determination, and in fact, the court did grant our motion for reconsideration and said that the 5% late fee would not be a monthly late fee post-judgment, because post-judgment there would be no more payments that are due. Well, it's the same argument that's made with respect to the maturity. I don't know that the court specifically said, you stipulated to it, too bad. I think the court said, I don't buy that there's a 5%, there can't be a 5% monthly late fee after maturity, but pre-judgment. So the district court at least agreed with us that there wasn't a stipulation because they got rid of it with respect to the judgment.
They didn't get rid of the stipulation, but the court did make a, in essence, in further ruling as to that 5% after this argument.
Correct, and I think what we're saying, the post-maturity, we think that's a pure question of law that the court erred on.
Okay.
Thank you
very much. Mr. Meyer.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I want to address the issue of Section 3.5B of the agreement. The provision that they're relying on is saying this creates the possibility of an exception. It says any other person whose action or inaction may be related to any loss, parens, exclusive of any loss resulting from such person's failure to pay on a loan made by the failed bank, incurred by, and parens, incurred by the failed bank. So there is an exception to the exception that says if it stems from a failure to pay, which obviously any type of collection issue, priority dispute between competing lenders, all of those things flow from a failure to pay in a default, because if you don't have those things, then, of course, you never get to those types of issues. So clearly this does not come within the provisions of 3.5B, and when it comes right down to it, through everything that they've argued through the case, today that's the only thing they can try and point you to, and it just doesn't get you there. Again, the PAA transferred the interest.
The analogy of the Wachovia Wells Fargo versus the FDIC conduit type thing that Mr. Merrill is saying, that's a total acquisition through a merger. Live assets and liabilities, you take in a merger.
Right.
This is different because it wasn't 100% of the assets and liabilities. It was a selected schedule. What's your position on that?
Well, again, I think that there's a little misconception about what the transaction was. The transaction was this bulk transfer of assets, and then essentially what they are doing is leaving themselves room on down the line to have the FDIC come back and say, okay, we're not transferring this. We are going to hold on to this. It seems strange,
but that's the thing. You get, BB&T gets a benefit from that, and kind of segregate some of those assets, whereas I'm sure Bank of America is sorry to say they bought merged with Countrywide and got stuck with all those liabilities.
Okay.
Whereas if it had been done through the FDIC or Chapter 11 or something, Bank of America wouldn't have inherited all those Countrywide claims and all. So there is a distinction, though, between the two.
There is a distinction. I don't think it applies when you go back to what the district court did, which was, we think, misinterpret the purchase and assumption agreement as a means of deciding whether BB&T had standing to proceed. And so if you take that issue in isolation, I think you have to conclude that the PAA was prima facie evidence of standing. Once we've met that burden of production, the ball then passes over to R&S to come back and say, wait a second, there's some other evidence there. So that's what I meant when I said we think that the district court, in essence, asked us to disprove one of their affirmative defenses.
We understand that. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Geiger, are you done? Or I shouldn't speak for my colleagues, but if you have something else to say, this is kind of an unusual argument. Anything else you want to say? I'd like to give you an additional minute just to make sure we haven't missed anything.
And I don't, on my actual issue of the interest calculations, I don't have anything to add. If the court wants to ask anything on the BB&T, I mean, I have my own opinions on that, but
we won't go there. I think Mr. Meyer's done a very capable job in BB&T, then like that. Okay, well, with that in mind, thank you all for this very exciting and interesting case. And now we got the hard part. We'll look at where we were, all the cases. So we'll look at the various portions of the agreements the parties have cited to, and then we'll proceed from there. And again, if the Zang, I don't know if the Zang case matters, on the equitable subrogation, not subordination, I'll get the right terminology, subrogation. So if you feel you need to have any input because of that pending case, will affect that issue, because that will probably be decided before this one. And now that's an en banc case, this is a panel case too. You might just take a look at that and see if you want to participate any further in that.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you
very much. The case was